This is the Best of Fair on the Mormon Faircast. This episode comes from the 2009 Fair Conference and is a talk delivered by Dan Peterson entitled The Temple as a Place of Ascent to God.
A native of Southern California, Daniel C. Peterson received a bachelor's degree in Greek and philosophy from Brigham Young University, and after several years of study in Jerusalem and Cairo, earned his PhD in Near Eastern Languages and Cultures from the University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA. Dr. Peterson is professor of Islamic Studies and Arabic at BYU, as well as a member of the board of an associate executive director of the Institute of the Study of Preservation of Ancient Religious Texts, which has produced computer digitized versions of the Dead Sea Scrolls, electronically recovered damaged documents from the ruins of, Herculaneum, Petra, and elsewhere, and is engaged in just joint publishing ventures with such institutions as the Vatican, Apostolic Library, and Rome. I'm going to skip the rest of his introduction because it's quite long and lengthy, and you can read it, other than the fact he served a mission in Zurich, Switzerland, which is where I served, so obviously he's a good guy. So with that, I'm going to turn the time over to Dan Peterson.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here. I hope everybody else has enjoyed this as much as I have. Some of you have been around here for a long time. Maybe some of you are just recently joining or coming into contact with the organization, but the quality of the work associated with FAIR has increased exponentially over the past few years. I mean, this is really a spectacular development, and I think a great thing, and I'm just really proud of all the people who've been involved with it. And these conferences are becoming absolutely first rate. So I hope you will tell your friends and get involved with this more, bring more people out, get more people to the website. This can do a lot of good for members of the church and for investigators and so on. So anyway, you know, reflecting on some of the things that have been said at the conference, I was struck by my brother White's comments yesterday about being Latter-day Saints first and apologists second. I mean, it's really more important, most important, that we be disciples of Christ. I've met a few people in my time who actually were apologists first and had kind of forgotten that they were disciples. And I don't mean by that merely that they sometimes were rude and obnoxious in discussions with people. I mean, they just really literally were not active in the church or anything else, but they did feel the need to defend it online. That's kind of getting your priorities a little bit mixed up. What I'm going to do right now is a little different than what I typically do, and in some ways I'm embarrassed by it. I had a number of topics, as I typically do, that I was considering doing. In fact, typically at this stage I'm still sort of deciding what my topic will be. This time I'm bound into it. PowerPoint has that impact. You know, it was suggested, well, I could still abandon my notes and go on with my talk, but you'd notice very quickly that there was a disconnect between my PowerPoint and whatever I was saying, and I thought that might become obvious. My normal theme is something on the order of those who disagree with me are idiots, you know, chapter 4 or something like that. But that's not what this is going to be, and in some ways I'm kind of embarrassed by it because it's not going to be particularly funny, I don't think. Well, maybe it will be, but it won't be intentionally funny. And I don't know that it's going to be all that original for most people. You can almost see it as a kind of devotional thing. This really emerged, began, and still is, a fireside that I gave in connection with the Ochre Mountain Temple open house just a few weeks ago. I know there are at least two people in the audience, three people that I know of, who saw that, and I apologize to you because I'm really not changing anything. It's going to be the same thing. But I was asked to do this, actually, and so I'm going to do it. And what I want to explain to you about what I'm doing is I want to talk about the temple as a place of ascent to God. You can sort of deduce that from what's on the screens. To treat the temple as a model of reality, a reality of things to come, and to talk about ascension motifs around the world. I'll only be sampling what is really a vast, vast literature, a vast assemblage of traditions. Because the idea of ascension is connected with the temple all around the world. And the idea of ascension is all around the world. I'll, as I say, only be touching a few cultures, very limited number, limited by time, limited by the slides that I could steal from my colleague Bill Hamblin. I had to beg, borrow, and steal to get the ones I got. I was going to make a Bill Hamlin joke, but I think I won't. But there's a lot more where this comes from. And our goal, ultimately, we've taught a seminar on this a couple of times, to talk about ascensions worldwide and to organize them so that non-Mormons will, I hope, profit from it, but Latter-day Saints, who are familiar with the temple, will see patterns. And I'm hoping some of you will see some of that today. I better get on with it. The idea of ascension is ubiquitous, fancy word for omnipresent, in the world. You find it in the New Testament. For example, 2 Corinthians chapter 12, where Paul tells in modest language what is probably his own experience. "It is not expedient," he says, "for me, doubtless, to glory. I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. I knew a man in Christ above 14 years ago, whether in the body I cannot tell, or whether out of the body I cannot tell. God knoweth. Such an one caught up to the third heaven. And I knew such a man, whether in the body or out of the body I cannot tell. God knoweth. How that he was caught up into paradise, and heard unspeakable words, which it is not lawful for a man to utter." Now, this idea of ascension, which is presupposed there, also presupposes a structure of the cosmos, which is indicated roughly here. You can see, if you can read it at all, I know it's fairly small for those in the back, but basically you have the idea of Sheol, the underworld below where we live, the earth, you have the earthly temple there, you have a heaven, second heaven, the heavens of the stars and so on, of the sea, and then the third heaven, the abode of God. And everything is arranged in this kind of hierarchical setting. There is a celestial temple that corresponds to the earthly temple. The windows of that heaven that separates the celestial sea from us are the windows through which God sends blessings. They're the windows through which rain comes. That's a good explanation of how water falls out of the sky onto us. And also is an explanation, by the way, of how meteorites sometimes hit us, because that heaven up there is actually made out of rock, and every once in a while a piece falls off. You know, so a meteor hits you. It all makes a certain amount of sense. I mean, it's scientific in a way. It did account for the observed data. But this idea of three heavens and so on, it underlies Paul's experience. It also, I think, is clearly related to some other things that we know about, the idea of a celestial, terrestrial, and telestial kingdom. There's some things about that passage in 2 Corinthians 12 that I want to point to. Paul says that this man was caught up into paradise. He heard unspeakable words, which it is not lawful for a man to utter. Now, there's a difference between those two expressions. The unspeakable words have to do with things that you just can't express. These are things that cannot be uttered. The experience is ineffable. But also there are words that it's not lawful for a man to utter. You might be able to say something about it, but you can't. You aren't supposed to talk about it. So on the one level, it's an incommunicable, in some sense mystical, using that word in a very vague sense, experience. And another, it's an experience that could be expressed but should not be. Now, let me show you a couple of other images related to this. The idea of ascent, of course, you know it's biblical not only from Paul's story, but also from the story of Jacob's ladder. This is a medieval account of that, people going up into the heavens, the ladder of divine ascension, and the imps and devils are trying to pull people off the ladder, and they're successful with a number of them, you know, pull them off into the flames of hell below. But if you're lucky, or good, or whatever it is, if you belong to the right theological faction of medieval Christendom anyway, you will make it up to the top of that ladder and be saved. Christ himself, according to the New Testament account, ascended into the heavens. And here you have the hand of God reaching down out of that cloud, that veil-like cloud, to pull him up into heaven as he goes up into the sky. You see the disciples asleep and so on below, and there are a lot of things going on in this. So this idea of ascension, the idea of going up literally into the presence of God, is common throughout the New Testament. It's also, and through the Bible itself, it's also common to the Book of Mormon. And you have a story, of course, of the three Nephites that is very, very similar in its language to this account of Paul's ascension into the heavens. In 3 Nephi chapter 28, verses 10 and then 12 through 17, you have this. And I include 10 for a very deliberate reason. starting off with verse 10 of chapter 28 of 3 Nephi. And for this cause ye shall have fullness of joy. It's talking to the disciples. And ye shall sit down in the kingdom of my Father. Yea, and your joy shall be full, even as the Father hath given me fullness of joy. And ye shall be even as I am, and I am even as the Father, and the Father and I are one. Now this is talking specifically to the three disciples. Now, I want you to notice something about that, by the way. It's commonly said that Joseph Smith's idea of human deification or exaltation was a late development. This is something that comes about in the Nauvoo period of the church. That's actually not true. Even section 76, if you look at the date on it, is amazingly early. It's February of 1832, right? So this is very early. It's less than 2 years after the foundation of the church. But the idea of exaltation is already present there in this passage in 3 Nephi. I mean, listen to the language. Ye shall be, this is Christ speaking to the disciples, ye shall be even as I am, and I am even as the Father. Now, have any of you had elementary mathematics? You know the rule, you know, if A equals B and B equals C, then what does A equal? C, right? Okay, Savior, intermediate between Father and humanity. He's, you know, in mainstream Christian language, he's divine and human, the man, God. You know, he has human nature and divine nature. Anyway, the Savior says, you will be like me, and I am like the Father. Okay? If you're going to be like B, and B is like C, then you're going to be like C. So there's a promise of exaltation right there, it seems to me. And the Father and I are one, which means you will be too. And you will be one with the Father as I am one with the Father, because you'll be like me. Okay, so there's a lot going on in that little verse. Now, did Joseph Smith notice it? I have no idea. But it was there already when the Book of Mormon was published, before the church was even founded, or about the time the church was founded. Okay, now here's the part that I really wanted to get to with Ascension, starting with verse 12. And it came to pass that when Jesus had spoken these words, he touched every one of them with his finger, save it with the three who were to tarry, and then he departed. And behold, the heavens were opened, and they were caught up into heaven, and saw and heard unspeakable things. And it was forbidden them, see the two categories here, things that could not be spoken and things that should not be spoken. Now they were caught up into heaven, and saw and heard unspeakable things, and it was forbidden them that they should utter. Neither was it given unto them power that they could utter the things which they saw and heard. And whether they were in the body or out of the body, they could not tell, for it did seem unto them like a transfiguration of them, that they were changed from this body of flesh into an immortal state, that they could behold the things of God. But it came to pass that they did again minister upon the face of the earth. Nevertheless, they did not minister of the things which they had heard and seen, because of the commandment which was given them in heaven. And now whether they were mortal or immortal from the day of their transfiguration, I know not. Now the point here is that additional to the kind of matter that's covered in Paul's account, is this transfiguration, which may even have changed them into immortality, certainly altered the nature of their being. They come back and they minister upon the earth, but they're forbidden to talk about the things that they've seen. Now, I'm going to argue that the temple is a kind of model representation of this kind of experience. But again, I want to point to the omnipresence of the idea of ascent. Here, for example, is an illustration of Dante's Mount Purgatory. If you remember the Divine Comedy, that hilarious slapstick work of medieval poetry. It starts off with the Inferno, of course, and the Inferno is a kind of counter-Mount Purgatory. I mean, you're burrowing down further and further into the depths of the earth to the lowest circles of hell, right, where the worst people are, where Satan himself is. Then eventually, if you prove worthy, if you aren't trapped in hell, you get to climb up Mount Purgatory. And as you climb Mount Purgatory, you are shedding your earthly sins, moving closer and closer to the presence of God. Again, this idea of ascent unto the presence of God. And here's an image of Dante's geocentric universe. Again, not unrelated to ancient ideas that had been around for a long time. The details change. But the earth in the center... By the way, you know, when people say that modern science has displaced the ancient notion that the earth was at the center of the universe, so it's made us all feel less exalted and so on and so forth. It's humbled us. Well, ancient people didn't put the earth at the center of the universe because they thought that was the place of honor. That was the worst place. You know what's at the center of Dante's universe? Hell. It's in the center of the earth. The earth is in the center of everything. The heaviest things fall down, lightest things, spirit and fire and flame go up. rock and dirt and all that stuff go to the center. So it wasn't a place of honor for the earth to be at the center of the universe. It was a place of dishonor. You're trying to ascend to get beyond it. This is one of the many areas where Christopher Hitchens and his pals are simply wrong. You know, I mean, I don't know of any area significantly where they're right, but the idea that somehow modern science, you know, got rid of this exalted notion of humanity being at the center of the universe is just nonsense. But anyway, there you have, you know, with the various heavens. This is more than three heavens. You have the heavens of the various spheres, the planets, and so on, and then the area eventually of where God dwells. Just to illustrate that. Eventually, this idea, by the way, the sort of Ptolemaic universe, is spiritualized. You find that in Plotinus, the great founder of Neoplatonic philosophy, that salvation consists in a mental ascent to God. You have, in the Islamic tradition, which is my particular focus, Avicenna or Ibn Sina or Al-Farabi or Al-Kirmani, the extraordinarily obscure philosopher who was the bane of my dissertation. They all have a notion of salvation as ascent up through, mentally and spiritually, up through the Ptolemaic universe to the presence of God, at least metaphorically. Now, and it's common in Islamic mysticism and other mysticisms as well, the idea of ascension unto God. But I want to talk specifically about the mountain of the Lord's house, the cosmic mountain. Here's an illustration of the cosmic mountain, the mountain of paradise. This is from a Greek Christian traveler of the 6th century by the name of Cosmas Indikoplaustes. But it's typical. It represents the kind of image that you would find just about everywhere. God dwelling on mountains was hardly a new thought to the Christians. Think of Mount Olympus. Think of Mount Meru among the Buddhists. Mount Sinai, of course, in the Bible. God is associated with mountains. Think of the Mount of Transfiguration. The mountain of the Lord's house was sometimes really a mountain. If you didn't have a Lord's house, you had a mountain. The saints, sometimes coming west, would go up onto mountains to pray. When they got to Salt Lake, before they were able to build even the endowment house, they went up onto Ensign Peak. George Q. Cannon, who's been mentioned in this conference, received his endowment on Ensign Peak. So it was very, very common for mountains to be associated with and artificial mountains to be built by people who were trying to get into the presence of God. I'll come back to it, but the Tower of Babel is probably an artificial mountain, a kind of ersatz temple, an attempt to falsify, to forge the rituals that would get you into the presence of God. In the Psalms, Psalms 120 through 134 are known as Songs of Ascent, Songs of Degrees in the King James Bible. It's the so-called Pilgrim Psalter, and these were songs that were sung by people who were coming up to the mountain of the Lord's house into Jerusalem. Jerusalem is literally on a mountain ridge. If you're coming up from Jericho or from the sea coast over on the Mediterranean, you're climbing up to Jerusalem. And it's a pretty steep climb in some places. And then the temple itself was thought to be the Lord's mountain in the tops of the mountains. So they would sing these songs of ascent. If you read those psalms with that in mind, they make a lot of sense. Jerusalem is literally 2,500 feet above sea level. That may not seem like much when you're sitting where we are, but if you're coming up from the sea coast to the Mediterranean, it's a climb, and a climb in a fairly short order. Here are the words of Isaiah chapter 2. You're familiar with these, the first through the fourth verses. The word that Isaiah the son of Amos saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem: it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, Come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Now this was a common motif in that period. A near contemporary of Isaiah was the prophet Micah. It's the 8th century B.C., or late 8th century B.C. And Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 5, he has essentially the same thing to say. But in the last days it shall come to pass, the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow unto it. Now you know that these passages were also referred to Salt Lake by the Latter-day Saints, the temple, the mountain of the Lord being built in the top of the mountains, again. And many nations shall come and say, come, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and he shall judge among many people, sounds very similar so far, and rebuke strong nations afar off, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts hath spoken it. For all people will walk, every one, in the name of his God, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. Now, I mentioned already the Tower of Babel is a kind of satanic counterfeit of this, that people living in an area largely without mountains built a counterfeit Mount of the Lord as a way of ascending into the presence of God. I don't think they really thought they were going to build high enough to get up into the presence of God. It was a fake temple with fake temple rites and all that sort of thing, a ziggurat as we now refer to them. And we don't have any living examples of them, but here's a marvelous building at Samarra, which is not too far from Baghdad in Iraq. And this is the minaret of the old mosque, the old Abbasid mosque there in Samarra. The mosque doesn't survive, but the minaret still does. And you can see, this is an aerial view, looking down it, you can see the steps going up in this circular fashion around the minaret to the top. There's a totally irrelevant story about Samarra that I always like to tell whenever I mention Samarra, just because it's so fun. It has absolutely nothing to do with the talk. But at this point, we're being so solemn, I just felt I had to do something. It's a wonderful story that shows up in Arab folklore about a very kindly master who has a servant. And he sends his servant, they're living outside of Baghdad, or just near Baghdad. He sends his servant one day into the marketplace in Baghdad. The servant's only gone a little while and comes racing back to his master's estate and says, he's terrified, you know, and the master says, what's wrong, what's wrong? And he said, I went into the marketplace and I saw death there in the marketplace and he made a threatening gesture at me. I'm terrified. I've got to get away. He's after me. So can I go to Samarra tonight? And the master very kindly says, yes, by all means, go to Samarra. Get away from here. So the servant takes off and the master goes into the marketplace in Baghdad and he looks around and finally he finds death there. And he goes up to him and says, how dare you threaten my servant? And death says, oh, no, I wasn't threatening him. You see, I have an appointment with him this evening in Samarra and I was just shocked to see him here. Make of that what you will. But anyway, this is Samarra, and you see it is built in Iraq, and it's probably modeled on surviving examples, to the extent they survived at that period, of ziggurat architecture. Now, there's only one other minaret that I know of like this. It's in Cairo, Egypt, attached to the Mosque of Ibn Tulun, and it was built by somebody who was from Samarra originally. So they carried that idea of the ziggurat with them. But this was the idea that you go up into this tower, and the god dwells on the top of the tower. Not in a minaret. Muslims don't believe that. But in Babylonian mythology, the god dwelt at the top of a tower. You know, gods often dwelt at the top of a cosmic mountain, and this was a symbolic architectural representation of it. Now, the question is, who could enter into the mountain of the Lord's house? So if you look in the Psalms, you actually get temple recommend questions. A little different from ours today, but they're recognizably temple recommend questions, in a sense. Listen to this. This is the entirety of Psalm 15. Lord, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? He that walketh uprightly, and worketh righteousness, and speaketh the truth in his heart. He that backbiteth not with his tongue, nor doeth evil to his neighbor, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor, in whose eyes a vile person is condemned, but he honoreth them that fear the Lord, he that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not, he that putteth not out his money to usury, nor taketh reward against the innocent, he that doeth these things shall never be moved. Or here's another one from Psalm 24, verses 3 to 5. Again, it begins with the phrase, who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who shall stand in his holy place? Now, I'm not going to do a Jesse Evans Smith imitation. He that hath clean hands and a pure heart, who hath not lifted up his soul unto vanity, some of you will remember that, nor sworn deceitfully, he shall receive the blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. But there are entrance requirements for entering into the mountain of the Lord. Now, what is the connection of this with the temple? We'll already even see that we're talking about the mountain of the Lord's house, sometimes a literal mountain, sometimes an artificial one. But there's a strong connection to the temple. First of all, I wanted to cite a verse. Again, I'm on this kick trying to show that there are things in the Book of Mormon that foreshadow what's going to come up later, even though some critics will say, the Book of Mormon doesn't contain a lot of things that become characteristic of Mormonism in later years. Listen to this from Mormon chapter 9, verses 11 to 13. See if it isn't a pretty good summary of at least the plot, if you will, of elements of the temple. It talks about God who created the heavens and the earth and all things that in them are. Now listen to the kind of organizational rhetorical structure of this. Behold, he created Adam, and by Adam came the fall of man. And because of the fall of man came Jesus Christ, even the Father and the Son. And because of Jesus Christ came the redemption of man. And because of the redemption of man, which came by Jesus Christ, they are brought back into the presence of the Lord. Now, I don't know, that just struck me one day, having just come back from the temple, that was pretty good stuff. But the temple, let me read a line from Margaret Barker. Margaret Barker, who's become sort of quasi-canonized within Mormonism these days. And for good reason. Yeah, good grief. I mean, some of you have heard the story. She came to... Has everyone heard the name Margaret Barker? You've heard us talking about her? Margaret Barker is a Methodist biblical scholar in the UK. And I don't know who was the first person to find anything by her. I like to claim it was me. Now, I can claim it because I don't claim any special virtue for having done so. It's sheer dumb luck. I was at an annual meeting of the American Academy of Religion, Society of Biblical Literature. Excuse me. And the thing I go for, I don't care about the lectures. I mean, they're okay, but it's the book sale. You know, everything's on half price or 90% off. I mean, it's wonderful. You know, anyway, it's the bane of my wife's life. It's not just the cost, it's the space. But anyway, I was sitting there one day, you know, going through the books, and there was a book by Margaret Barker called The Great Angel sitting there on the shelf, and it sort of glowed, you know, buy me. And so it was heavily discounted, so I did, brought it home, didn't read it for a while. And then I picked it up one night and began to read it, and here's this woman who's talking about how she was looking at the question of how early Jews, who were supposed to be monotheistic, could have come to the belief that there was a father and a son. You know, and some scholars have argued that, well, it was because there were early Greek converts and they brought the idea of demigods like Hercules into the equation. But she said, no, it's totally Jewish. They were hearkening back to an older Jewish tradition that there was a father, El, or Elohim, and a son, Jehovah, Yahweh. And then pretty soon she's talking about the idea that God might have a consort, a wife, you know, and this sort of thing. And I'm reading this thing and thinking, okay, this has got to be a Latter-day Saint. It's just got to be. And then she talked about things like Melchizedek priesthood and the importance of the temple and all that sort of stuff. And then I said, no, it can't be a Mormon. Then I said, no, it has to be a Mormon. Well, anyway, we finally discovered she was a Methodist and all that sort of thing. We had her out to BYU once to do a presentation, a sort of master class for some of the faculty. And she was going on. She didn't know anything about Mormons, nothing at all. And she's going on and on about these things like, well, at one point she was sort of apologetic, mentioning the idea that, yeah, the evidence seems to suggest that the earliest Israelites believed God had a wife. And I, you know, hope I'm not offending you. And we were assuring her that we could handle it. You know, and then this Melchizedek priesthood thing, she said, I don't know what it is, but I'm really curious about it. And so we were kind of snickering and casting glances at one another. She finally realized that there was something funny here. And she told me afterwards that she'd called her son back home and told him some of the things she was discovering. And he said, Mom, that's really spooky. Because she has worked her way through to a lot of things that are, you know, really amazingly similar to Latter-day Saint views on these things. But anyway, Margaret Barker is very interested in the temple. I'm going to quote her a few times in my remarks today. Here's one thing she says. The earthly sanctuary, whether it was the tent or the temple, that is the tabernacle or the temple, was thought to reflect a heavenly pattern. One of the keys to any understanding of the temple cult is the realization that the rituals and the personnel were also thought to be the visible manifestations of the heavenly reality. There are characters in the temple who represented divine characters or celestial characters. The priests were the angels. The high priest was the representative of the Lord. Now, according to Mircea Eliade, who's a great Romanian scholar of comparative religions, so the temple in Jerusalem in particular had, you know, three parts, which he says correspond to the three cosmic regions. The lower court represents the lower regions, Sheol, the abode of the dead. The holy place represents the earth, think of the terrestrial kingdom in the middle. And the Holy of Holies represents heaven. The temple is always the meeting place, he says, of heaven, earth, and the world of the dead. Now, isn't that what the temple is, in a way, today? I mean, this is an Egyptian temple, cut away, showing the entryway to the temple, a great gate, the monumental gateway, and so on. And as you enter into the temple, quite often in Egyptian temples, the floor rises and the ceiling will sometimes lower. You're going to a more and more holy area the further you go back into the temple. The tabernacle, likewise, had areas of increasing holiness as you come in from the outside. Solomon's temple, areas were ever more restrictive, ever more holy. Herod's temple as well, in the court of the Gentiles, the court of the women, eventually the Holy of Holies. I mean, you're going deeper and deeper into the divine as you go into the temple. In modern temples, what do? We actually ascend, right? In some of the older temples, it's a physical ascent. Salt Lake Temple, I'm not giving away any secrets here, you know, as you go through the temple, you're actually climbing. What's at the lowest point of the temple? The baptismal font. If you see ancient representations, and I was too lazy to get one, I meant to get one and I didn't, I forgot about it, but there are common representations of the cosmic mountain from the ancient Near East. Typically the deity is seen as residing at the top, but from the bottom you'll have four, say in typical representations, four sort of jagged lines coming out representing water, the sources of life, the waters of life coming out of the basement of the cosmic mountain. Well, think of the temple today. Where is the baptismal font? It's in the basement, or the base, at the base of the temple. And then as you ascend up into the temple, you're going up to the higher regions. In the Salt Lake Temple, for example, the higher you go up, the further you're coming up toward the celestial room, symbolically toward the presence of God. These are very, very common temple motifs. Now, I want to look particularly at the temple and the Garden of Eden, the mountain and the Garden of Eden. In the Quranic narrative of the fall of Adam and Eve, one of the things that's most apparent is that the fall seems to be thought of literally as a physical descent, a physical fall from an elevated location, from a high place to a lower. And in this context, I think it's worth noticing the extraordinarily interesting 28th chapter of Ezekiel, which expressly draws upon the Eden story to make a point regarding the king of Tyre. And listen to this in a modern translation. The word of the Lord came to me. O mortal, say to the prince of Tyre, thus said the Lord God, because you have been so haughty and have said, I am a god. I sit enthroned like a god in the heart of the seas, whereas you are not a god, but a man, though you deemed your mind equal to a god's. Assuredly, thus said the Lord God, because you have deemed your mind equal to a god's, I swear I will bring against you strangers, the most ruthless of nations. They shall bring you down to the pit. In the heart of the sea you shall die, the death of the slain. Will you still say I am a god before your slayers, when you're proved a man, not a god, at the hands of those who strike you down? The word of the Lord came to me, O mortal, intone a dirge over the king of Tyre, and say to him, thus said the Lord God, you are the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and flawless in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your adornment, carnelian, chrysolite, and amethyst, beryl, lapis lazuli, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and emerald, and gold beautifully wrought for you, mined for you, prepared the day you were created. I created you as a cherub with outstretched shielding wings, and you resided on God's holy mountain. You walked among stones of fire. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created, until wrongdoing was found in you. You were filled with lawlessness, and you sinned. So I have struck you down from the mountain of God, and I have destroyed you, O shielding cherub, from among the stones of fire. You grew haughty because of your beauty. You debased your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I have cast you to the ground. Now this is a literal casting down from a high place, which is identified with Eden, the garden of God. So it's on a mountain. The temple, the mountain, the Garden of Eden, all these things associated together. The references to a cherub in that passage in Ezekiel certainly echo the Genesis narrative, as well as it seems the king of Tyre's ambition, thinking of himself as a god, grasping after divinity, blurring the distinction between human and God. It's reminiscent of the Genesis story. Again, going back to the Egyptian temple, it's been said that the colonnades, the pylons that are there in the entryway, just past the entranceway, represent, in many cases, the plants of a garden, a sort of celestial grove, and so on. So you start off with the garden there. Back to Margaret Barker. Descriptions of the temple suggest that it was Eden. Connection with the creation stories might strike you as familiar. It's connected with Eden, it's connected with the mountain, all those sorts of things. Ezekiel described a temple built on a high mountain whose courtyards were decorated with palm trees. She's drawing evidence from all over the book of Ezekiel. The interior was decorated with palm trees and cherubim, and from the temple flowed a river which brought supernatural fertility. Some of you may know that that the stone in the Dome of the Rock today in Jerusalem is thought by some to mark the spot or near the spot where the Holy of Holies of the ancient temple was, and that someday it will be removed and the waters that are underneath that temple mount will burst out and flow down into the Kidron Valley and then down the valley into the Dead Sea and heal the Dead Sea. Right now it just needs water of any kind. It's disappearing, but this would be miraculous water that would cause the Dead Sea to be healed. So it's the waters of life, again, coming out of the base of the temple structure. So Ezekiel didn't invent these Eden-like features. Each is mentioned elsewhere in the Old Testament. The temple on a high mountain was the theme of Isaiah 2 and Micah 4. The righteous were described as the trees of the house of the Lord in Psalm 92, a metaphor which would have been pointless had there been no trees there. 1 Kings 6 described the palm trees, the cherubim, and the flowers carved on the temple walls. And several prophets looked forward to the day when waters would flow from the temple. Hezekiah had removed a bronze serpent from the temple, and the seven-branched candlestick was remembered as the tree of life. That's what the menorah is, tree of life. Ezekiel, it seems, had a vision of a garden sanctuary like those known elsewhere in the ancient Near East, but it was also an accurate description of the temple he had known in Jerusalem. And then this from Richard Elliot Friedman. The temple was Eden, and its rituals will have interacted with this fundamental belief about the creation. The temple itself, like Eden, was between heaven and earth, with access to both the divine and material worlds. Finally, a comment from Margaret Barker. Since the temple was a statement about the natural order, it was closely associated with the myth of the creation. Now back to the cosmic mountain and the waters of life. One of the things that goes on with the waters of life is ritual cleansing, initiatory ordinances, if you will. Before the ascent, you have to be clean. Now, one of the best models of this sort of ascension story, but it's not the only one by far that you will find around the world, is the story of Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. There's a story about Muhammad who is taken from, and the story varies at different points, it's attributed to different points of his life, he's taken from Mecca or Medina, wherever it happens, to Jerusalem on a miraculous steed known as Burak, which means lightning. It's not Barak, it's Burak. So he's taken to Jerusalem, where he leads the former day prophets in prayer. But before all of this, according to many of the stories, the angel Gabriel comes, sometimes accompanied with two other angels, and they do something very strange. They split open Muhammad's chest, take his heart out, and wash it in icy water taken from the mountains in the north, and then replace his heart in his chest. It's a symbolic cleansing of Muhammad, a washing of him, before he begins this ascension story. And so you start off with that ritual cleansing. This from the Egyptian temple of Karnak. I'm just going to go through these very quickly. Presentation scene before the god. I don't know if you can see that even. Yeah, I guess you can. Purification and anointing. And then clothing and crowning. Not very clearly visible, but a little bit there. And clothing is often a part of this climbing as well. The person takes on new clothing at some point. Either as part of or as culmination of the ascension. Then you climb the cosmic mountain. You ascend through the heavens, through the planetary spheres, which are represented in many cases as veils or curtains or something like that. The story of Muhammad and the Mi'raj, the so-called ascension into heaven for Muhammad, is a really interesting one. He's taken from the area that is now marked by the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, where he begins to ascend a ladder or a staircase into the heavens. He comes up through seven heavens by this time in the development of that kind of motif, and each of those seven heavens is separated off from the one before it by a curtain. And in each of those seven heavens, there is a prophet of former days who's stationed there as the guardian. Muhammad is brought up by the angel Gabriel, who presents him at the curtain. The person behind the curtain asks questions whether he's qualified to enter in. And in each case, eventually he answers the questions correctly, he identifies himself properly, he's taken through the curtain and into that heaven. It culminates with him ascending actually into the presence of God after 7 of these ritual repetitions. Now, the heavens were thought of as being not just lifeless places, but the domain of God. And this is, you know, this is seeing it from down below with the eye of faith, if you will. This is the interior of the Dome of the Rock, the place from which the Prophet Muhammad ascended, according to Islamic legend. Unfortunately, the Dome of the Rock is almost impossible to get into nowadays. I used to wander into it all the time and took it for granted. Now, you can't get in no matter what. I mean, the last couple times I've been there, I've tried my most solid, unctuous charm, including speaking Bil Arabi. You know, it doesn't do any good at all. So anyway, you have to look at photographs of it. But believe me, it's unbelievably gorgeous inside. It's an enormous dome covering that rock. And it shows you the way they conceive of the heavens. This one from the mosque in Cordoba in Spain, giving the same idea. Here's an actual illustration of the 7 heavens. You wondered what they looked like. Here, in this case, you don't have the earthly temple as in Jewish or Egyptian mythology. You have the Kaaba, the Muslim shrine, that black cube down below. But you ascend up through the up through the heavens to the presence of God, and believe me, there'll be a celestial Kaaba up there as well, on which the earthly one is modeled, just as our temples are modeled upon celestial temples. Here you have an image of Muhammad at the veil. Muhammad is there before the curtain, about to be admitted into the presence of one of the prophets. There's another image from a text called The Ascension of Abraham, God surrounded by veils, and Abraham is being brought by the angel up to the veil just before the presence of God. And by the way, you see below him the winged chariot wheel, which goes back to the ascension of Elijah, another famous ascension story. That's the way you get up there in some cases, is with this fiery chariot that takes you up there, flaming fiery chariot. At some point, often through the curtain, there's an embrace. The deity welcomes you and brings you into his presence. But this is a little church in Athens that has been renovated to give it the appearance of a Byzantine church from early times, from probably the 5th, 6th century, somewhere in there. The exterior is not all that interesting, but here's the interior with the veil that marks off the altar. The priest can go beyond that, the congregation can't. But I thought, for various reasons, the veil was kind of interesting. But the idea of the veil was common even in churches. They didn't know what to do with it exactly, except that it marked off the altar from the congregation. But a veil was an imitation of the ancient temple. Now here's a passage from a description of the mysteries of Mithra that I like. You'll see that I'm gathering things from all over the place. You could describe this as parallelomania, if you will, but the fact is there's a kind of common ascension ideology that exists all around the ancient world, everywhere. China, ancient Greece, the Islamic world, Egypt, Babylonia, the Americas, India, Ethiopia. It's astonishing how common it is, which to my mind suggests that it goes back to either real experiences or be real rituals, or both, as the most common, most plausible suggestion of the commonalities that exist. But this is from Mithraism. The Mithraic religion was a real rival to Christianity, at least in some circles in the early Christian centuries. It was particularly popular among Roman soldiers, men. There weren't that many women involved with it, but lots of men. And they found Mithraeums, Mithraic sanctuaries in England, where the Roman military were stationed, and so on. This is from a book by Franz Cumont called The Mysteries of Mithra. The heavens were divided into 7 spheres, each of which was conjoined with a planet. A sort of ladder composed of 8 superposed gates, the first 7 of which were constructed of different metals, was the symbolic suggestion in the temples of the road to be followed to reach the supreme region of the fixed stars. To pass from one story to the next, each time the wayfarer had to enter a gate guarded by an angel of Ormazd, or Ahura Mazda, if you will, from the Iranian tradition. The initiates alone, to whom the appropriate formulas had been taught, knew how to appease these inexorable guardians. There are certain things you have to do and say when you get up to these barriers in order to enter into the presence of the god, or to get past the veil that marks off each heaven from the previous one. As the soul traversed these different zones, it rid itself, as one would of garments, of the passions and faculties that it had received in its descent to the earth. There's an idea of pre-existence here as well. You're just going back to where you came from. It abandoned to the moon its vital and nutritive energy, to Mercury its desires, to Venus its wicked appetites, to the sun its intellectual capacities, to Mars its love of war, to Jupiter its ambitious dreams, to Saturn its inclinations. It was naked, stripped of every vice and every sensibility, when it penetrated the eighth heaven to enjoy there and as an essence supreme, and in the eternal light that bathed the gods, beatitude without end. It was Mithra, the protector of truth, who presided over the judgment of the soul after its decease. It was he, the mediator, who served as a guide to his faithful ones in their courageous ascent to the Empyrean. He was the celestial father who received them in his resplendent mansion, like children who had returned from a distant voyage. Now that ought to sound at least vaguely familiar to you. I almost feel like breaking into Oh My Father or something like that. Now then, when you're back in the presence of God, all sorts of wonderful things might happen. Muhammad is called as a prophet. In many stories, people are deified. Muhammad, as I say, receives his call as a prophet in this connection, although there are other stories of his call. Here you have Muhammad seeing the celestial tree of life, and it's covered, according to this ancient or early medieval illustration, with jewels. Here's Muhammad in the heavenly mosque, the equivalent of the celestial temple, if you will. Here in Egypt is a depiction of the tree of life with the name being written on the fruit or on the leaf. Notice the faces have been carefully defaced by pious Christians. But now think of it. Paul, remember, also had a supernal experience going up into the heavens. He was caught up into paradise and heard unspeakable words, which it's not lawful for a man to utter. The three Nephites were caught up into heaven and saw and heard unspeakable things, and it was forbidden them that they should utter, neither was it given them power that they could utter the things which they saw and heard. And whether they were mortal or immortal from the day of their transfiguration, Mormon says, I know not. So something spectacular happens at this point. You become deified. You can no longer talk about the things you've received. You've been given some special endowment of power and knowledge. I'll conclude, I think, with a quotation from 3rd Enoch, chapters 11 through 13, which is one of the great ascension texts that I haven't referred to yet. Rabbi Ishmael said, "The angel Metatron, prince of the divine presence, said to me." Now, Metatron is Enoch, but at this point he's been changed into Metatron, the angel Metatron, who dwells before the throne. What it means, maybe. The Holy One, blessed be He, revealed to me from that time onward all the mysteries of wisdom, all the depths of the perfect Torah, and all the thoughts of men's hearts. All the mysteries of the world and all the orders of nature stand revealed before me as they stand revealed before the Creator. From that time onward I looked and beheld deep secrets and wonderful mysteries. Before a man thinks in secret, I see his thought. Before he acts, I see his act. There is nothing in heaven above or deep within the earth concealed from me. Rabbi Ishmael said, Metatron, prince of the divine presence, said to me, out of the love which he had for me, more than for all the denizens of the heights, the Holy One, blessed be he, fashioned for me a majestic robe in which all kinds of luminaries were set. And he clothed me in it. He fashioned for me a glorious cloak in which brightness, brilliance, splendor, and luster of every kind were fixed, and he wrapped me in it. He fashioned for me a kingly crown, in which 49 refulgent stones were placed, each like the sun's orb, and its brilliance shone into the four quarters of the heaven of Aravot, into the seven heavens, and into the four quarters of the world. He set it upon my head, and he called me the Lesser Yahweh. Now listen to that. He called me the Lesser Jehovah. That's deification. This is a Jewish text. He called me the Lesser Yahweh, in the presence of his whole household in the height, as it is written, my name is in him. Rabbi Ishmael said, the angel Metatron, prince of the divine presence, the glory of highest heaven, said to me, out of the abundant love and great compassion wherewith the Holy One, blessed be he, loved and cherished me more than all the denizens of the heights, he wrote with his finger as with a pen of flame upon the crown which was on my head, the letters by which heaven and earth were created, the letters by which seas and rivers were created, the letters by which mountains and hills were created, the letters by which stars and constellations, lightning and wind, thunder and thunderclaps, snow and hail, hurricane and tempest were created, the letters by which all the necessities of the world and all the orders of creation were created. In other words, he gives him the capacity to be a creator. He deifies him, declares him to be the lesser Yahweh, and gives him the power of creation. It's a remarkable thing. Now, as I say, it is my firm belief that the temple represents a model which itself represents a cosmic reality, a reality that involves access to divine mysteries, access to the waters of life, access to cleansing and ascension, access to the presence of God, a symbolic representation of admission into the presence of God, an endowment of power that goes with that, with the ultimate culmination of a blessing of exaltation in the presence of God. That's remarkable stuff. And it's remarkable that Joseph Smith restored these ancient models from the ancient world, living in 19th century America. But I'm not making this only as an apologetic point. I'm making it as a point to say that we as Latter-day Saints who aspire to defend and sustain the kingdom, should be aware of the riches we've been given. We should not forget what it is we've been given. It's not only a matter of defending it, we should live it and observe it ourselves and treasure what's been given to us. It's a remarkable thing. It's far more than we deserve or merit. It's the grace of God that gives it to us. I bear you my testimony that these things are true and that the blessings that have been promised for us are beyond comprehension. There's a wonderful passage in an Indian poet who was asked to give up his mystical experiences, his experiences basically of divine ascent. He'd had some inklings of this sort of thing, to give that up and come back to the orthodox legalistic religion that he'd been raised in. And his response was, "I have felt the back of the elephant moving between my knees, and now you want me to come down and ride on a donkey?" Well, that's the way I feel when people come to me and offer me other forms of religious experience, other forms of religious belief. I can't imagine anything more fulfilling, more wonderful than what we've been given in the gospel, even though we seldom appreciate it in its fullness. It's worthy of living, it's worthy of defending. I bury my testimony of that in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Thank you. I'll take an easy one first. Why would Muslim artwork depict Muhammad when Islam forbids depicting his actual image? Well, Islam doesn't. Wahhabi Islam does. The really hardcore, rigid, Sunni, to my mind, distasteful, fanatic form of Islam. I'm kind of showing my colors here. I tend to be very sympathetic to Islam, as some of you may know, but Wahhabism and those forms of Islam don't appeal to me much. And they will tell you it's the law of Islam that the Prophet cannot be represented. But hey, if that's the law of Islam, it's kind of amazing. There's a vast quantity of Islamic art depicting the Prophet Muhammad. You know, you have particularly popular the Miraj Names, the books of his ascension, which show him ascending into the heavens and show his face and everything else. Sometimes they'll just show his body with a flame on his shoulders, you know, so as not to show his face. But quite commonly, they'll show his face. So it simply isn't true that there's an absolute prohibition against the representation of Muhammad in Islamic art. That is a particular sectarian account of Islam, which happens to be characteristic of the vocal fundamentalist, particularly Sunni minority right now. And they managed to impose it on a lot of people and scare other people into accepting it, but it's not true. What is your response to critics who use the example of the King of Tyre's ambition to become a god as evidence against theosis? Well, obviously there are incorrect ways to try to become a god. The Tower of Babel was an illegitimate way. It was an attempt to force the way. The only way in is by the proper door. You know, the proper shepherd, the person doesn't gain access to the sheepfold by the wrong door. You go in the right way. You don't try to force your way into heaven or cheat your way into heaven. You go in by the way the Lord has outlined. Early Christians talked quite unashamedly about becoming deified and so on. They weren't afraid of that doctrine. It's all over the place in early Christianity. But there's also the wrong kind, the arrogant kind, that assumes we can become deified in our sins without following the path we have to follow and without the grace of God, without asking His permission. He can grant it, but we can't steal it. To steal it is wrong. And Lucifer was basically offering something that wasn't his to give. So, and with the King of Tyre, too. The King of Tyre was an arrogant person who sought to steal deity on his own, not by living righteously. Okay, could these similarities to our temple today be considered the relics of Christianity from the days of the ancients? Absolutely. Yeah, I think absolutely they can. And you will find traces in the liturgy of the Catholic and Orthodox churches and elsewhere in Christendom that represent, to my mind, survivals from that ancient time. And particularly in very old churches in the Middle East, in the Eastern Mediterranean, in Rome, you'll find the further you go back, the more temple similarities you find in my view. Question, considering the HBO Big Love rendition of the endowment recently, can the church honestly claim it was taken out of context if the church itself fails to clearly explain and or define what the context itself actually is? Well, I don't know that my primary line of criticism would have been that it was taken out of context, although in a sense I think it is ripped out of context because the temple will not make sense to a person who's not properly prepared spiritually and doctrinally for it. It will be to the Greeks' foolishness and to the Jews' stumbling block, as the gospel always has been for people who are not prepared for it. The temple will make sense for people who are prepared, and for those who won't, who aren't, it won't be. And so one of my labors, for example, in trying to prepare people to go to the temple is to get them into the right mindset so they can appreciate what's there. But I know lots of people who go, including Latter-day Saints, who aren't prepared and don't get out of it what they should get. Now hopefully they will someday. Some never do, I suspect. But showing it on HBO is, to put it mildly, not the proper context for the endowment ceremony. This is something that we regard as genuinely sacred, esoteric, if you will, but something where the truths of it are to be communicated spiritually and probably will not be communicated via Big Love. Okay. Mention Margaret Barker summary in Cumming Farms Review. Yes. Well, we have from time to time published things in the Farms Review and elsewhere with Farms of the Maxwell Institute from, by, and about Margaret Barker. And the next issue of the Farms Review, here's a commercial plug, will contain a couple of articles about some of Margaret Barker's recent work on the temple. So place your orders now. It's going to be good stuff. She is, she's got endlessly interesting things to say for Latter-day Saints. I don't think she realizes even now how interesting we find her. So, how do temple experiences, that is the endowment, fit into the Nephite experience if it is essential for salvation? Well, we don't know much about Nephite temples. My suspicion is that there were temple things going on among the Nephites, but that they kept them pretty quiet. But I can't prove that because they kept them fairly quiet. But we do have traces from early Christianity suggesting that even though there's nothing in the New Testament that would clearly teach you the temple endowment or anything like that, that there were things going on in early Christendom that were very closely related to what we now have as the endowment ceremony and certainly other things. You know, like baptism for the dead is only mentioned once in a kind of oblique aside by Paul, and yet there's evidence that it was practiced for quite a long while in Corinth. It was a pretty big deal for some people, but there's not a lot made of it. We do know that even baptism itself was sometimes regarded as a more or less esoteric ordinance in early Christianity, and that that non-members were not to be there. One of the proposed etymologies for the word mass is that it comes from a word having to do with being dismissed. You know, that catechumens, investigators, and non-members were told to leave before the administration of what we would see effectively as the sacrament. So they may have been much more secretive and closed and esoteric about early Christian ordinances than we are today. So it wouldn't surprise me that we would have almost nothing that would survive. Okay, I think that's all the questions. Thank you very much, and thank you for coming to the conference.
Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Tell your friends about us and help increase the popularity of this podcast by rating it in iTunes. Music for this episode was provided courtesy of Lawrence Green. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily the views of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or Affair.